We were displaced before to the south. There were also martyrs there and bombardment. Wherever we went, there were bombardments from one area to another, from Rafah to Khan Yunis, from Khan Yunis to Deir al-Balah. There were bombardments everywhere. We later came here. It is all the same. All displacement is for nothing. It is enough.
This comes as Save the Children reports Israel's killed more than 20,000 Palestinian children over the past 23 months. This means at least one Palestinian child has been killed every hour on average by Israeli forces. The group said, quote, if the international community does not step up, an entire generation of children in Gaza will be lost, unquote. Meanwhile, another six Palestinians have died of starvation, bringing the total to almost 400, including 140 children who've starved to death. For more, we go to Deir al-Balah in Gaza to speak with Ead Amawi, representative of the Gaza Relief Committee, coordinator for local NGOs based in central Gaza. He's visited Gaza City regularly over the last several days. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Ead. Can you just describe the scene as the Israeli military attempts to remove the entire population of Gaza City, 1 million people? The descriptions of the robots blowing up buildings are terrifying.
Yeah, thank you so much for hosting me again and again. The situation here in Gaza town, especially within the last 48 hours, the situation is worsening because the Israeli occupation announced targeting towers. Towers meaning a residential area that contains more than 100 apartments. You can imagine when they hit Susi Towers yesterday, more than 200 apartments with their residential people leave it, flee in the street without any basic needs. And the surrounding area completely destroyed from the bombardment. And this is a new techniques, dynamics from the occupation to force our people to be displaced without evacuation order, something like that happened before. So the situation by the bombardment for the landmarks of the Gaza, it's the baddest situation now. There's no real safe zone in Gaza town and all of the Gaza Strip. As your guest mentioned before, no free spaces remains in the south. So the Gaza town, or most of our peoples there, I witnessed, they forced to be displaced to the western part, to the coastal area, and also without tents or shelters or guaranteed shelters also. And the shortage of the sweet water, it's the basic things nowadays, because the summer heat and also spreading the infectious diseases between the children, especially, and the elderly people also, because the crowded area is unbearable conditions here.
Schools have been turned into displacement camps, Ead. Now, schools were supposed to open this week after summer break. Are any children in Gaza going to school?
That's a great question. There is no functioning schools remains functioning nowadays. Most of our schools is targeted, have been targeted for a long time, and me and all of the international media witnessed the direct targeting for the schools. The beginning of the educational year yesterday began, and really there is no educational process launched until this moment. Just personal initiatives in the camps, they try to lure some children, not all. So there is no a systematic operation functioning now, my colleague.
You talk about hunger. And also write to your own family, Adamawi. If you can talk about what one international agency is calling catastrophic hunger of 500,000 people, the whole population is 2 million. What exactly this means? And is aid getting to people, or people still being shot down as they try to go get food from this shadowy Israeli-American GHF, so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation?
The famine also is worsening more and more, even though the limited number of trucks entering the Gaza. Our needs is more than 600 daily needs. But what the Israeli occupation gave the permission just for 15 from our needs, 15% of our needs. So they use another way, with another dynamics, with the hidden manners to manage the famine and to increase the suffering by blockade some special nutritious food, like animals, proteins, and eggs, and fruits, and vegetables. They just entering some limited amounts of food that keep us alive with a limited amount of carbohydrates. And this is a system of starvation and a collective punishment that will increase the immune diseases for the children and also elderly people. So the famine is take another face by another actions. We will lose our next generations because the consequences of continuing starving the children for more than 700 days. So in all of our human appeals here, to call of the international community to do interventions, to let trucks entering freely without Israeli occupation restrictions. Because our children, we have no time to save their lives after the 150 days of strongest siege over them.
And what about the role of the United States? How critical is this? You have Netanyahu continuing his corruption trial. Many are saying he's continuing the war on Gaza to make it difficult to finish this trial. The significance of the U.S. pressure on Israel.
Yeah. We hope here as humanitarian workers and NGOs coordinators at all, there is some real pressure over Netanyahu government and the Israeli occupation government. Without real pressure, the genocide here will not stop. Look, we heard a lot of promises for a long time before to bring peace for Gaza. Until this moment, I heard the bombardment and they hit it and order a new evacuation for new towers. Now, in this moment, when I talk to you, they send a new order for a new tower. So we hope that the new talks and the statements of the official of the America to get more insist over Netanyahu to stop the genocide, because we have no time, I mentioned before. And also Netanyahu government and the Israeli people there must deal with the Palestinian here in Gaza as a civilians and increase the pressure over Netanyahu to stop the genocide and transfer the captives and the hostages. All of the things must end now. As a human being, the most priority is the life of the civilians here. It's enough.
Adamawi, I want to thank you for being with us. Representative Gaza Relief Committee Coordinator for local NGOs based in Deir el-Balah in central Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to calls for justice in the killing of Ayşenur Ezgi Aygi, a 26-year-old Turkish-American citizen, a student at UW, University of Washington, shot in the head and killed by Israeli forces 1 year ago on September 6th when she was taking part in weekly protests against Israeli illegal settlements near Nablus and the town of Beita in the occupied West Bank. Aisha Noor's family says video evidence and witness accounts show an Israeli sniper targeted her, even though the Israeli military claimed it was highly likely she was hit indirectly and unintentionally as soldiers fired at protesters who they say were throwing rocks. Meanwhile, an investigation by The Washington Post determined she was shot half an hour after any clashes and that she was at least 200 yards away from the soldiers. Turkey's foreign ministry issued a statement on the anniversary of her death this weekend, saying, quote, the killing of innocent civilians is a clear indication of disregard for human life and international norms. Turkey will resolutely continue its efforts to ensure that this grave crime against Aisha Noor does not go unpunished, unquote. Turkey's investigation into her killing is ongoing. The family's calling for the U.S. to conduct an independent investigation. She's a U.S. citizen. The family met with the Biden administration's State Department, but says nothing came out of it and right through to now. Israeli soldiers and settlers have killed at least 10 U.S. citizens since 2022. No criminal charges have been brought in any of the cases. For more, we're joined in Portland, Oregon, by Ozden Bennett. She is the sister of Aisha Noor Ezgi-Aigi and now an advocate with the For Aisha Noor campaign seeking justice and accountability for her sister's killing. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Ozden. Again, our condolences on the death of your sister 1 year ago in the West Bank. Talk about the moment you heard that Aisha Noor had been killed, this University of Washington student.
It was easily the most horrible, unbelievable moment of my life. I mean, when we talked about risks and my sister going to the West Bank, you know, death was definitely at the top of my list and concerns, and to receive a call and to be woken up by my husband in the morning saying that she was dead and that she was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier. It was the worst news, the worst case scenario come to life. And the days, hours, weeks following were like a nightmare. And I wish no family has to experience what we experienced. And yet there have been multiple American families that have had to go through the same exact experience that we did since my sister was killed.
Last year, your family held regular vigils outside the White House and a news conference outside the Capitol, where one of the speakers included Democratic Congress member Pramila Jayapal of Washington State.
I am absolutely appalled with the lack of movement on this case, the lack of attention from the State Department, the U.S. State Department, for the well-being and the safety of our own U.S. citizens. Nothing that I have heard from the State Department gives me any assurance at all that the killing of a United States citizen by the IDF is being treated with the urgency that it deserves. And this is all particularly galling when the U.S. continues to provide unfettered aid to Israel, bullets, bombs, weapons, violating our own domestic Leahy laws and international humanitarian law.
So that was Washington Congressmember, Seattle Congressmember Pramila Jayapal a year ago. This is during the Biden administration. Now President Trump is in charge. What has happened from that point until now when it comes to an investigation into the killing of an American citizen?
Absolutely nothing. What Congresswoman Jayapal said that we heard just a moment ago is exactly where we still stand today. There has been no forward motion, really no communication, no political willingness to seek not only a U.S.-led investigation, but basic details or information they can provide us, the family. It's been a essentially crickets in silence. And from what we can hear from our elected representatives, they've also been essentially stonewalled into, you know, from any meaningful legislation or information, and met with just.
So you have Mike Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to Israel under Trump, saying there must be accountability for this criminal and terrorist act. Has there been any movement? He said that, I think, in June.
There has been no movement. There has been a lot of nice words, but no action to back it up. No meaningful pursuit of justice and accountability for my sister.
So since your sister's death, at least two more U.S. citizens have been killed in the West Bank. Saifola Mosalet, beaten to death by Israeli settlers, and Khamis Ayad, killed in another settler attack, with their families also pleading for a U.S. investigation. Have you united with other families? And, of course, going back to Shireen Abu Akla, the world-renowned Al Jazeera journalist who was killed by an Israeli sniper May 11, 2022. She was also, she was Palestinian-American.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, as you've mentioned, we're now part of a group of families who've experienced losing their loved ones to killings by either the Israeli military directly or illegal Israeli settlers enabled by the Israeli government. And we will actually be making a trip to Washington, D.C. next week with some of these family members, coming together and sharing our stories to showcase the repeated pattern of not only Israeli violence extended to American citizens, but their ability to do it with full impunity, zero consequences.
Who exactly will you be meeting with in Washington, D.C.? And given the expanded criticism of Israel by even AIPAC-supported Congress members and the increased calls for weapons bans on Israel, are you finding more elected leaders across the political spectrum who are willing to stand up for Aishinoord and the other Americans killed?
We're hoping to meet with our elected officials and those of the families that will be with us. So Aishinoord Senators Cantwell, Murray, and Congresswoman Jayapal, hopefully Adam Smith. And as you mentioned, there has been a shift towards being more supportive of Palestinian rights and maybe being more vocally critical of the Israeli government, and we're hoping that we can use that momentum and public change in discourse to push for a meaningful investigation and justice and accountability, not only for my sister, but for all of the families that have been impacted since her killing.
Can you talk about the response of the University of Washington, of UW, where your sister, Aishinoord, had just graduated? The response in the community, there were major protests last year, like there were across college campuses. Aishinoord was one of the leaders of those protests before she went to the West Bank, engaging in peaceful protest.
Yes. You know, I like to think of the university kind of in two terms. One is the overall community and the students who have been so supportive and wanting to not only honor Aishinoord's life, but to really share her story and the impact that she had on campus. And that has been really wonderful to see and to be a part of. On the other hand, I think you have the university leaders and the president, when this happened, President Kelsey, who was really empathetic to us as the family for our loss, but unwilling to make any public political statements or even a call for a U.S.-led investigation, and that resistance to kind of speaking truth to what's happening has been really disappointing to see.
Azin Bennett, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Again, our deepest condolences, sister of Ayşenur Ezgi Aygi, the 26-year-old Turkish-American citizen, activist, student who just graduated from the University of Washington, killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank last September. Azin Bennett is an advocate for the For Ayşenur campaign seeking justice and accountability in her sister's killing. When we come back, the acclaimed psychiatrist and author Robert J. Lifton has died at the age of 99. We'll play an excerpt of an interview we recently did with him. Back in 20 seconds.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield.
Down by the riverside.
Down by the riverside.
Performing Down by the Riverside in our Firehouse studio decades ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show remembering the acclaimed psychiatrist and author, Dr. Robert J. Lifton. He died Thursday at the age of 99. He wrote more than 20 books about the psychological ramifications of nuclear war, terrorism, genocide, as well as the death penalty. In his New York Times obituary, psychiatrist Anthony Storr quoted describing Dr. Lifton as fascinated by the reaction of human beings to extreme situations. In 1967, Dr. Robert J. Lifton won a National Book Award for his book, Death in Life, Survivors of Hiroshima, about the 90,000 survivors of the first atomic bomb dropped on a population. In 1986, he published the seminal book, The Nazi Doctors, Medical Killing and the Psychology of Genocide. He appeared on Democracy Now! Several times, including in 2017, after he published the book, The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. It was 9 months into President Trump's first term. Some of his closest aides and advisors were saying Trump was unstable and unraveling, and that the White House was increasingly consumed by chaos. Trump was also slated to announce the U.S. would decertify the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear deal. I interviewed him along with Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh.
Is it your sense that there are sufficient restraints on Donald Trump acting unilaterally on either of these fronts,
of course there
climate
are not.
Or nuclear?
You'd have to have total restraints for them to be sufficient with a man like Donald Trump. Of course there aren't sufficient restraints. And whoever depended upon generals to restrain a civilian in so many different areas— And we don't know the outcome. I'm not, in my book or in my work, promising that we've accomplished enough to prevent climate damage and real disaster from happening. It's happening already. What I'm saying is that there has been a shift in mindset that makes possible the actions, the sensible actions necessary to curb global warming. We still haven't taken those actions fully. And, you know, at the beginning of my book, I speak of the ultimate absurdity that if we do nothing but what we're doing now, and it's what I mean by malignant normality, just go on using fossil fuels, we will do ourselves in as a civilization pretty much by the end of this century. Nothing could be more absurd than that. But at least we have a beginning shift in mindset that allows us to take reasonable action. And that's what Paris was all about.
I wanted to ask you about the quote you begin your book with. You quote the American poet Theodore Röttgen saying, "In a dark time, the eye begins to see."
Yes, that's a beautiful line from a very great poet. I've used that throughout my career because it's, in a way, what my work is about. I've studied a lot of descents into darkness. Hiroshima, the Vietnam War, Nazi doctors and others, Aum Shinrikyo in Japan. And I always feel there's something to be learned from what happened. And it doesn't mean that we're guaranteed to make good use of our history and never do it again. It does mean that some kind of knowledge can come from it. And I see myself in that way as what I call a witnessing professional, trying to use my professional knowledge to bear witness to and in some way reveal more about this kind of darkness.
Can you talk more about the Nazi doctors? I mean, you devote a chapter to them here, but I mean, your work spans, you are 91 years old now.
Yes.
You have so much wisdom and both experience and all you have brought to this. Tell us what we should learn from what you learned from these men.
With the Nazi doctors, when a German doctor who would be a member of the Nazi Party was assigned to Auschwitz, he was expected to do so-called selections and send most arriving Jews to the gas chamber. That was considered normal behavior for a doctor in Auschwitz. Some of them had difficulty with it, but ultimately they adapted to it. This is rendering professionals a hired gun for a malignant version of normality. And I learned that in extreme ways, professionals can be put to use for killing rather than healing. That's what happened in Nazi Germany. But we also saw expressions of that, not quite as fully expressed, but with American psychologists and for a while psychiatrists engaging in torture, and that being an expected normal behavior.
You're talking about the American Psychological Association cooperating with President Bush.
That's right. I'm talking about both individual psychologists and psychiatrists, and then the American Psychological Association collaborating with the torturers. I call that a scandal within a scandal. It's a scandal that professionals are doing that, but it really shows that we have to, as professionals or as anything, recognize what our work is being used for and where it's being put in connection with despotic behavior. The scandal within a scandal is an association that's supposed to watch over the ethics of a profession joins in torture, or at least protects those who join in torture. But all that was exposed by a movement from within psychologists, from within the American Psychological Association, with the help of reasonably good leadership on the part of the American Psychiatric Association, who said it was wrong for any psychiatrist to be in the room during an interrogation that could spill over into torture. Yes, that those were examples of malignant normality, not in Nazi Germany, but in relation to a democratic United States of America. And with Trump, of course, malignant normality becomes the rule because he's president, and what a president does tends to normalize potentially bad, evil, or destructive behavior.
Acclaimed psychiatrist and author Robert J. Lifton speaking in our Democracy Now! Studio in 2017 in one of his many interviews on the show. You can go to democracynow.org to see them all. Robert J. Lifton died at his home in Cape Cod at the age of 99, survived by his partner, Nancy Rosenblum, his son, Kenneth Lifton, and four grandchildren. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.